This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, and welcome to the Ghibliotheque, the podcast that shuffles through the shelves of films from the world's greatest animation studio, Studio Ghibli. I'm Michael Leader, and I've seen the lot of them.
And I'm Jake Cunningham, and I've barely seen any of them.
So join us in our quest into the glorious world of Ghibli. So Film 4, this summer, are doing a full Studio Ghibli retrospective. I do all things digital for Film 4. I'm also a podcaster on the side. I host the White Lies magazine film podcast. And I decided to rope in my esteemed colleague, Jake Cunningham.
That's me. I also host a podcast for Curzon Cinemas here in the UK, as well as working in commissioning for short films for Channel 4. But I've never seen any of these Ghibli films. And every day across the desk, Michael glares at me in disappointment. And now he's finally been able to remedy that.
Yeah, the glare is softening with every episode.
It is. We've got someone else in the studio.
We have indeed.
Our first guest in the Ghibliotheque. We've allowed them through the precious doors of our library.
And sitting down in a cozy armchair, we have Beth Webb, writer and programmer for the Bechdel Test Fest, Little White Lies, Empire Magazine, and BBC Radio as well. Beth, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me, boys.
We're going to be delving into history and context, as well as Jake's first or second impressions. This is one you've seen before, I believe.
Yeah, we haven't actually said the name of the film.
Uh-huh.
It's My Neighbor Totoro. This was the very first Ghibli film that I saw. That must have been 6-7 years ago. And I remember watching it and thinking, I love this. I'm going to watch all of these films. And proceeded to never watch another one again.
Well, we are partway through remedying that right now. Beth, you have seen Totoro, I presume.
I've seen it so many times.
And can you give us a taste of your knowledge of Ghibli? Is this the one that you've seen, or have you seen many of them, a handful of others?
I'd say I've seen a fistful of Ghiblis, I think.
Yes.
So I'm sort of halfway between the two. I think this was the first Ghibli film I've seen. I was trying to think about the first time I'd seen it, and I can't remember. I honestly can't. Mm-hmm. I wish there was this like profound experience that I had where I was like, oh my goodness. But all I know is that I watch it often, and it's definitely the film that I kind of recommend to friends. If I'm having like a blue day, I'll sit and I'll pop it on. I've been to the cinema to see it. Mm. Michael, we've seen it together before.
In the rain at Film 4 Summer Screen at Somerset House last year. What a magical experience.
Yeah, the absolute downpour. I don't think I would have sat through that for anyone but Totoro. Mm-hmm.
Well, you did write a piece for Little White Lies earlier this year for the 30th anniversary of the film. We need to make sure we put that in the show notes.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Looking at the making of and impact of
Totoro. I have something of a special bond with Totoro in that I was born 2 days before it was released in Japan. I really wanted to just explore it and talk to like-minded people about the film, and it was a real pleasure to write about. I really enjoyed writing about that.
To Two sisters, Mei and Satsuki, move into a dusty old house in the countryside with their university professor father. Their mother is convalescing in a nearby hospital, and they are counting down the days until she is discharged. Each day brings new wonders as the sisters explore the house and its neighbouring natural world, from the soot sprites that hide in their home to a family of troll-like creatures that live in the roots of a huge camphor tree in their garden. Chief of these is King Totoro, a large, round, furry friend who comes to the rescue when Mei goes missing, enlisting the Cat Bus, a 12-legged feline vehicle, to help reunite the sisters and reassure them that their mother is on the road to good health.
Listeners to our previous episode on Grave of the Fireflies would have remembered that that film was made in conjunction with this one, My Neighbor Totoro. So now it's time to look at the second half of that double bill.
Yes, it is. We're going to go all the way back to the mid-late 80s. This is when Studio Ghibli had only really just been founded as a studio. They'd made one film under the Studio Ghibli banner so far called Laputa, and they still had to tussle with finances to get their films made. I'd like to start with Hayao Miyazaki. I love his production notes, his creative statements before he makes films. He had a long one for My Neighbor Totoro. He said, My Neighbor Totoro aims to be a happy and heartwarming film, a film that lets the audience go home with pleasant good feelings. But he's also very interested in it being a specifically Japanese film. He says, though we live in Japan and are without doubt Japanese, we continue to create animation films that avoid depicting Japan. In this age of internationalisation, we know that the essentially national is what can become most international. It's interesting, running on from his previous film, Castle in the Sky, known as Laputa in Japan, that was set in sort of a fantastical version of Wales, or at least a fantastical world based on Wales. And likewise, Nausicaa, his film before that, was set in a fantasy world. He wasn't making specifically Japanese films and wanted to turn it around here. And he wanted to capture, this is another quote, what we have forgotten, what we don't notice, and what we are convinced we have lost. So he put this pitch together and went to Tokuma Shoten, who were the main owners and financiers behind Ghibli at the time, and they weren't interested in this twee adventure about two girls and a furry forest ghost spirit type guy. Yeah. They wanted these big epic adventures from Miyazaki, specifically ones that had interesting foreign-sounding titles. So he found it hard to get this project off the ground, and it seemed that it was going to be a straight-to-video 60-minute animated film. But when Grave of the Fireflies, that project, landed on their desk, and Shin Shosha, the publishers, said, we'll put up the full budget for Grave of the Fireflies, the producer, Toshio Suzuki, who we've said before is this...
Yes, he's the
shrewd businessman. Yeah. He saw an opportunity utilising a sort of peculiar, specifically Japanese social kind of point of etiquette. He said, this is a quote from a great interview which we'll put in the show notes. He said, the plan was for Shin Shosha and Takuma to join hands and each create a movie that they would release as a double feature. Shin Shosha has a longer history, and since that's the kind of thing that presidents of publishing companies really care about, President Takuma would have to accept it if the president of Shin Shosha requested it. So he literally got the president of pretty much the Penguin of Japan, this like old publishing house, to call up the younger company and say, we're going to be involved in this, you should be involved too. And they went along with it. So they managed to pull off this amazing coup where this film that had been rejected was then suddenly greenlit.
I love
in
the way that
bill.
you talk about the production of this film as if it's a heist.
It's kind of like that, isn't it?
And they pulled it off. Would you believe it?
Well, that's how Suzuki talks about it. He says, and then the rest was easy. That would be a great Oceans type film, wouldn't it? I mean, and the rest was easy until the release, when we covered this in the Grave of the Fireflies episode, where it was a very hardcore double bill. You have this 80-odd minute adventure with, you know, woodland spirits, followed by or preceded by two kids struggling to survive in the dying days and the firebombings of the end of World War II. So whichever way you played it, it wasn't really a great evening or afternoon out at the cinema. But Totoro did get acclaim. It won awards at the end of the year, all the big awards for animation in Japan. And then, a couple of years later, once Ghibli start thinking about merchandising and licensing their properties to ancillary products, Totoro takes off and becomes pretty much the Mickey Mouse, the Winnie the Pooh, the...
Well, he's the logo of the studio.
And becomes the logo of the studio, yeah. It's a fascinating point where, in the history of the company, where they'd been quite precious about the themes and the messages of their films, suddenly they'd realise, let's play a bit of the game here. Right. Let's do merchandise. That's how we can get in the public consciousness. And then internationally, it made it to the UK first, actually. It had screenings at the Barbican in 1991 as part of an anime festival or a Japanese film festival. But then it did get a US release in 1993, localised by a subsidiary of Troma Films, the sort of schlocky, horror, gross-out film company that made Toxic Avenger and The Class of Newcomb High. And so they ended up bringing this wonderful, cute film to the States.
It's a natural progression, I think.
It really is, yeah. And that was when Roger Ebert reviewed it. And Roger Ebert, who would later become a huge champion for Miyazaki and Ghibli in the States, he wrote about it saying, "Whenever I watch My Neighbor Totoro, I smile and smile and smile." And just as one final point, talking about reception, one big fan of My Neighbor Totoro, one you wouldn't expect, is the Japanese legendary filmmaker Akira Kurosawa of Seven Samurai, Rashomon, Ikiru fame. He, at this point, was very late in his career, late in his life, and he saw this film and then placed it in his top 100 films of all time. And there's a great article online where it's like a fireside chat between Hayao Miyazaki and Akira Kurosawa, where suddenly halfway through, I picture in my head as Akira Kurosawa just leaning over and saying, "By the way, I really like the cat bus." And he says in that interview, "Those are the kinds of things that people like me in this business can't do. And that's something I'm really envious about." This is, you know, Kurosawa is one of the great artists of what we call live action cinema compared to animated cinema. And he's really jealous of what Miyazaki can pull off. It's a really fascinating route through, and it becomes this touchstone. It becomes the logo.
Ends up in Toy Story 3.
Exactly. It pops up everywhere, actually. I saw it in an X-Men comic as well. Totoro becomes a real emblem for the studio internationally.
Michael, when were you first introduced to Totoro?
I'm similar to Beth, actually. I can't remember the first time I watched it. We'll get to my sort of route through these films as we go through the series, I think. My first Ghibli film was Princess Mononoke. Then I saw Spirited Away at the cinema. My Neighbor Totoro was released in the UK on DVD in around 2006. Mm. So it must have been around there that I watched it for the first time. I bought it on DVD and watched over and over. I've seen it in cinema. And then most recently at Film 4 Summer Screen last year, which was some of those magical moments where it's an outdoor screening in London. And you look at the programme and you think, this programme has this moment where it rains. And if it rains at this point, it would be incredible. And it was a night last year in August where it was raining all the way through. But as we'll see, this is a film that gives itself over to participation through umbrellas.
I'd be like if I was saying it was a comfortable evening, but it was like, it was beyond atmospheric. It was really magical.
And the hardcore fans turned up. Yeah. It's one of those where rain does affect play and people might want to stay home, but people turned up for that. Mm. And it was such a special evening.
Well, sadly, I wasn't at that screening. But I have now caught up with the film. So
let's get into the film.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Okay, so let's talk Totoro. Jake, you mentioned that it was several years ago when you last watched this. Watching again with fresh eyes, adult eyes.
Yeah.
What struck you?
There's so much here. I don't have to worry about where I would rank this film. That's your job to do later. But this is definitely my favourite one.
Oh, yeah.
And the thing that I'd forgotten about it is the music and just how quickly that score comes in. And it's really different. It develops over the course of the film. It feels like occasionally we've got four different scores going on at once. And the first note of the score are just fantastic. They sound like this weird Ghibli Super Mario Brothers theme tune that I really loved. And there are just moments in the film where any dialogue drops out, like narrative might even drop out, and you're just being completely led by movement and music. And it's so wonderful. And there are a few scenes that I'm sure we'll pick out over this review. I know Beth's got some dance moves that she might like to share.
It's not a dance move, it's a routine. And it's
completely on topic here. It's not just, this is not frivolous.
No. But I think like Joe Hisashi, for me, is just kind of all over this film. And he's completely key to it. And this is, for me, like that first introduction to him.
Well, that's what's interesting. He does the score for, I think, all but one of Miyazaki's movies. And so has a long history of working with him and working with Ghibli. And it's very much, if you think about the defining features of all these films, he ranks quite highly. And Spirited Away is often seen as one of his, you know, big scores. But I think this is the one. What I find so fascinating about his music and thinking about him in context of Japanese composers at the time, he has a classical minimalist background, but he dabbles in electronics. But then he also has a great melodic sense. And the score here, there are at least three themes that are burned into my mind. There's, of course, the one that no one can get out of the head once we say Totoro, Totoro. there's also one that is this beautiful 1960s, almost Disney music theme that brings to mind Sleigh Ride, the Christmas song, or Summer Holiday. You can sing the lyrics to those. But then also that ethereal nighttime theme, which you mentioned Nintendo music. You can completely see that they're working from similar backgrounds there. It sounds like it could come from Legend of Zelda or some of the creepier Final Fantasy scores, maybe.
It's very majestic, and it's got those beautiful kind of chord progressions for those like grander moments, like when they're on top of the tree and they're making the plants grow. But then you've also got these really kind of childlike sounds, like a moment that springs to mind that's so different and so varied is when May falls into the camphor tree for the first time and she's nestled on Totoro's belly and his whiskers are kind of going nuts. And I don't know how he manages to... It just adds such a magic moment to that introduction, that kind of innocence and wonder and, you know, meeting for the first time and sort of the absolute delight on her face as she kind of realises what he is. And he's sort of a little bit suspicious, but also not bothered because he's falling asleep again. And you've got that, but then you've also got, yeah, like I say, these real moments of kind of majesty that he manages to create that really just lends this magic to what is already a very beautiful film.
It's part of really what you leave the film remembering, the music. Yeah. Almost on a scale that not many other films, or if you think of bodies of work from other studios, you may have the big song from a Disney movie, for example, but you don't have themes on a soundtrack that worm their way. What I like about Joe Hisaishi, which is I'm not sure if it's apocryphal, I'd love to speak to some of you who may know better, but it's a stage name. Joe Hisaishi, it's not his birth name.
Right.
He developed it early in his career, basically ripping off and transliterating the name of the American pop producer Quincy Jones. So if you flip his name like into Japanese format, so surname first, and it's like it's Hisaishi Joe.
Right.
It's kind of, apparently in kanji if you wrote Quincy Jones.
Wow. Amazing.
No way.
Which citation needed, really, but
has anyone ever seen Joe Hisaishi and Quincy Jones in the same room?
I certainly
have. Let's delve into what there is of a story in this one. And it starts for me with familiar Ghibli territory, which is a moving house. And girls in the back of the car.
Yeah, similar to, Spirited Away, but they're excited in this one as opposed to being uprooted in the way that Chihiro was in Spirited Away. But very similar, isn't it? This idea of movement and moving into a new area being upheaval for the character. It's really fascinating. And what I love about those early scenes is that it's these adventurous girls.
Yes.
They're not scared by anything. There's a bit where Kanta, the boy, comes over and goes, "Yeah, you live in a haunted house." And they're like, "We don't care, we're going to go run around around and
explore well, there's, anyway. They've got these very authentically childlike voices that I think are like borderline shrieking because they are so excited.
Yeah.
It's slightly grating at points, but that's what makes it feel real, that they are slightly annoying kids.
I find it delightful. I completely disagree, probably because I was that child. It's just when you can't get the words to describe that, like, kind of dizzy, giddy, and you just have to let it out. I'm all for it. Shriek away, girls.
Yeah. But they shriek about the fact that they shout, "It's a haunted house!" And they've got these enormous smiles and they're running around and they can't control themselves because the prospect of living in a haunted house is actually exciting, which is really different.
No, I love it. And there's this kind of hesitation with May, but she so desperately wants to be the same as her sister. So you see that hesitation, and when you see the soot gremlins sort of dancing away, and you could tell for that moment she's scared, but then she sees the fearlessness in her sister, mm-hmm. and she copies her. And I really like that kind of copycat essence, because that's so true of childhood. You know, you look up to your older siblings, you look up to your peers, and you want to be just like them, and she so desperately wants that. I think it's lovely. I think it's a real kind of true slice of what it is to be a sibling and to be a little child.
It's such a good sibling movie.
Yeah.
You know, Miyazaki and his director's statements always seem so, I don't know, intellectual and serious in his you know, ideas and his aims. But he does say in interviews how that idea of being alone and thinking that there may be a ghost or something in the house with you, and the idea of laughing, he said that's what he does. Mm. You know, there's an interview that says he was recently in a hotel on his own and he heard creaks around the building. He thought, I'm going to laugh and laugh and laugh, and they can't get me if I laugh. And there's something so genuine about that.
Yeah, really. Well, that sounds like the ridiculous spell from Harry Potter.
Ah.
To get rid of a dementor, you just have to turn it into the thing that makes you laugh.
Yeah. Exactly. But something that he does mention in his director's statement that is so magical, literally so, is this magic of the everyday, just the idea of opening up a dusty old house, wandering around, getting a well working.
Yeah. Listen,
I think the first half an hour of this film is just that.
We
don't get bogged down in much at all. And it's so nice to watch, just to see the workings of this building in this space and just to explore. And that's it.
Yeah, it's made it a child's pace without being dull and something that I would consider a slow film. It's made it the pace of children moving house. That's the premise for the most of the film, and it's still completely enchanting.
And of course we do meet these soot spreaders, dust bunnies, whatever you want to call them, which appear in with legs in Spirited Away as well.
Yeah, and more importantly in our little thumbnail on iTunes. Well. I think that's their most iconic appearance.
A shout out to Sophie Moe of Little White Lies and Church of London fame for providing us with that artwork.
So we've got this this lovely opening 30 minutes where we are just exploring the forest and the house and the attic and the well. And that's really lovely. And because it's so nice and you're so wrapped up in the world, you don't really notice the fact that we've only really met the dad and the daughters. And then we meet the mother of the family, and she's in hospital. And that's really the first kind of narrative point that it locks into.
Mm-hmm. As part of the article that I wrote, I spoke to a really fascinating woman called Helen McCarthy, who wrote a book about Hayao Miyazaki called Hayao Miyazaki, Master of Japanese Animation. She really knows her stuff. And something that we spoke about very briefly is the theme of death that runs through Totoro. And I think it's really interesting to acknowledge that it's very much a theme, but what she said to me, and I'll just quote her, is it allows death to assume a role in the movie without personalizing or demonizing death. And I just thought that was a super interesting point, because
there's that point about halfway, about the half an hour in, maybe. Yeah. So you've had the sort of jaunts around the house and the garden and everything, and then you find out, you know, where the mother is. Mother's convalescing, and it's a way for the film to acknowledge death and parents' mortality, you know, and Totoro is this spirit that comes and fills that void. And it's one of our, I don't know if it's actually a theme throughout the movies, but absent parents, absent mothers.
Yeah.
We see that in Grave of the Fireflies as well.
Well, and Spirited Away is her
being separated from her parents. It's something that is there. It's a texture of the film, to the point where people, you know, serious critics, adult critics, see it as a darker film than it probably is.
What I think is really impressive is within that first 30 minutes, the world building and feeling for adventure is so rich that you almost don't notice it. So it's quite a punch when you are taken to the hospital and you actually understand why they've ended up in this house and what the family dynamic is at this point. And so then when you're introduced to Totoro and this just unending joy is brought into the world. It's so lovely.
Mm-hmm. That sequence where it's May on the day where her sister's at school and it's her dad like beavering away on whatever scholarly work he's working on, and she sees one of the smaller Totoros darting off through the undergrowth or whatever it is, and she follows him. It's such a great sequence, isn't it? One of those, we talk about these sequences that are just perfect on their own, and this is one of many in this film. And when she finally, as you said, Beth, just clambers up on top of this, I mean, what is Totoro is the question we want to ask, right? What is this guy?
Well, she just says, you're Totoro, as if she knows already.
And that's partly what makes this film so fantastic, is there's no definitive answer. We could debate this for the rest of the podcast on both a physical level, like he's had comparisons to seals, owls, trolls.
But he's furry as well.
But he's furry. And then when I watched it this week and saw kind of like dog-like mannerisms for the first time, and sort of the kind of the way that they sort of glance sideways, and the sort of loyalty, but then also on like a metaphysical level it's been compared to something called Kami, which is like a spirit tied to nature. So, you know, is it tied to the camphor tree? Is it a he? Is it a she?
Is it a god?
Is it real or not? I know that Miyazaki encourages you to either, you know, can believe it's a figment of their imagination or it's real and that's up to you, or that he says that he believes that Totoro is real.
100% it's real.
Yeah. It's like in Peter Pan, like, would you clap to bring Tinkerbell back kind of thing? Like, do you believe Totoro is real? Do you believe in him? I love that. I love how accessible it is, how you can interpret it and project onto it whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
And I think therein lies the magic. It's your experience that you're taking away from that. It's your projection.
And that's the projection that May's making. You see in the credits at the end, the line is, you're a Totoro, when she talks to her sister and says, I've met Totoro. Has it been Totoro, like in your storybook? Mm-hmm. Over the closing credits, you have these depictions of the family in different moments. And there's one where it's the daughters reading a storybook. And it seems to be the Three Billy Goats Gruff, that sort of folk tale, fairy tale. But on the back cover, there's a face that looks just like a Totoro.
Right.
And so there's a suggestion that it's from her storybook, and that's the name she ascribes to Totoro.
I read it as a Totoro, in that there. So you have these three. Yeah, you have these three little creatures, and their species is Totoro, and they are a Totoro. And you have the king one, and the blue one, and the white one.
Well, design wise, you can see a lineage from, there's a film that Miyazaki worked on with Isao Takahata in the early 80s called Panda Go Panda, and it's adventures of a girl with a massive panda who has at least the dimensions of a Totoro.
Right.
And his early sketches for what would become Princess Mononoke featured a huge cuddly, it looks like Totoro with the cat bus's face,
right,
for example. So it's interesting. It's such an interesting character to dig into.
The cat bus, the nightmare fuel of the cat bus.
Yes, my brother is absolutely to this day terrified, to the point where when I was watching it last week and I sent him a picture of me watching the cat bus, and he was like, why are you watching it? Why are you sending me this? He's 26. Like, he watches scary films all the time. This is the one that haunts his dreams.
Sounds like you're the one that's haunting his dreams by sending him.
What sisters do, isn't it?
Right. But the cat bus appears in what I think is the absolute standout sequence from this film, the bus stop rain sequence.
Yeah.
Which, again, the sense of the magic in the everyday. Miyazaki just homes in on this one thing, which is standing at a bus stop with an umbrella with drops of rain from the trees above you landing on the umbrella and making funny noises.
It's these two girls just waiting to pick up their dad from the bus stop.
And he turns it into this beautiful, almost silent short film.
Yeah,
it's incredible. And then the cat bus is one of the great surreal animated creations.
Yes.
The fact that the door is part of its body and you're sitting, it makes that noise. You've got the sort of mice that are on its eyebrows that are the headlamps.
And that like maniacal grin on its face. Like, it's I can see why he gets upset watching it. Just these all-seeing eyes.
Well, and when we get into the nighttime and with the cat bus, I think we go back to Joe Hisashi. He really lets loose here.
Yes.
The cat bus music is Looney Tunes. And the nighttime stuff is when we're getting into that ethereal realm that I think becomes that Spirited Away sound that almost becomes a musical trademark for Ghibli.
Yeah. Well, and also it's that realm of dream and fantasy. I know, Beth, one of your favourite sequences is that when they plant the seeds in the garden, yes, and at night the Totoros come out and have a little dance.
They do a little dance. They do a sort of three jumps in a row forward, and then you've got to kind of squat down and nestle down, and then you've got to do just a big reach to the sky. Like, you've got to really work up a sweat doing it. But I encourage you to go away and do it, because it's really good fun, especially if you've got younger, like, family members. Go away and teach them to do that. It makes for a good Sunday afternoon.
Mm. And much like you demonstrating that dance to us, I would say that this film is also timeless. Michael, when we were talking about this film yesterday, you said My Neighbor Totoro is the perfect Miyazaki film.
Yeah.
Why is that?
I think this is just precision-focused Miyazaki. I think almost all his feature films have something to recommend them. That magic is there, present throughout. But this is the one where theme, animation, story, everything, the sense of experimentation and the surreal are all there. I think it all focuses down on that one moment where they tell their dad about Totoro, and he says, oh, he must be the king of the forest. We should go and pay our respects at the shrine. And they find this shrine, and they're paying their respects. And there's another shrine that pops up later on in the film when Mei gets missing. And it's just really deftly, without dialogue, really, or without didactic dialogue, brings together these threads of the magic in the everyday, the beauty of nature, and the sort of the natural pantheon of gods and spirits that lie just beyond our realm of understanding. And that's one of his messages throughout all his films. And this is one that is told so well that a child can understand it, and adults too, without some of the issues that he'll bring into his later films or his longer films, where plot really gets in the way of the enjoyment, or plot really makes things more complicated than it should be. And then this sense that this is a film with no clear antagonist, no clear structure, no clear stakes, but such a sense of wonder and fun. So I think this is where all of that is chiming at once. Yeah.
I'm going to take a wild guess and say that you like this film.
Yes.
Yeah. So, soft-like. Michael Leader, let's put it on the leaderboard. So we're three episodes in, and so far we have watched Spirited Away, Grave of the Fireflies, and now My Neighbor Totoro. The leaderboard as it stands has Grave of the Fireflies at number one, Spirited Away at number two. And where is My Neighbor Totoro going to slot in?
Well, I think there's only one place it can go, and that is top of the pile. I really think this is the one to beat, the gold standard. Beth, would you say this is gold standard for you?
I would say this is absolutely top draw.
I think this is, in terms of all films, one of my favourite.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree. I think, as you say, with that means of timelessness, it doesn't really lend itself to an era. It's clearly a time before now, but I mean, it could apply to any time. And as I say, I just love that you're so able to project onto that whatever you like, and that Miyazaki is able to create that in such a delightful way. I think, it's one of my favourite films.
Well, Beth, thank you so much for joining us today, talking about Totoro. It's been a real chore for you, I'm sure.
I mean, you know, not all heroes wear tiny acorn hats and dance in the rain.
Where can people find more of you if they want to find more of you?
So you can find me on Twitter at Beth K. Webb.
And we recommend that you do.
Mm. And we hope you've enjoyed your time in the Ghibliotech. Next week, we'll be taking Whisper of the Heart off the shelf in an episode that we've dedicated to Michael's choice.
Yes, this one is a bit of a deeper cut, a cult film. One that's not directed by Hayao Miyazaki, though he did write the screenplay. And spoiler alert, it's one of my favourites. I can't wait to talk about it.
Great. Until then, you can follow Michael on Twitter at Michael J. Leader.
And you can follow Jake on Twitter at Jake H. Cunningham.
Ghibliotech is a Little Dot Studios production. We record at Soho Radio. Our music is made by Anthony Ng. Our artwork is by Sophie Moe, and Steph Watts helps us out with all of our GIFs, images, and anything else we post online. The show is produced by Michael Leader, Jake Cunningham, and Harold Scheel. That's me. I do the voiceover for the credits as well.
Thank you for staying past the credits. We like to give you a little bit of extra trivia for those that do. One thing I'd like to point out this week is we talked at length about the bus stop scene, the iconic moment where the girls and Totoro are waiting in the rain with their umbrellas. It's actually the poster of the film, but those eagle-eyed listeners will see that it's actually one girl standing next to Totoro at the bus stop, and she has Mei's pigtails, but sort of Satsuki's dimensions. And that's because that is based on concept art from early in the production, when it was meant to be one girl, not two, going on an adventure with Totoro. The second sister was only added later on when Miyazaki wanted to enlarge the film to a feature length and add some extra stakes.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.